My name is Dan Weatherspoon. I'm the organizer of the Why I Stay panel, the session every year. It began exactly 15 years ago, and it's become a Sunstone tradition that we have one plenary during the day that features people who have definitely imbibed Mormonism deeply through their own journeys. They've seen things and, you know, maybe don't feel as comfortable sometimes in certain aspects that go on. And yet through their wrestling, through their own call, through their own centering with God, whatever it might be, have chosen to still be with us, to still be in the pews, to still be serving and blessing the group. And that's certainly who we have as our three speakers today. I am thrilled to introduce, well, first of all, is Toby Pingree here? I haven't seen him. Toby was the one who first conceived this, and then I've been doing it about the last 7 years. I always want to give him props if I see him. Our first person who's going to speak, who already told me that you guys have made her emotional before she came, is the wonderful Susan Hinckley. She has a BA in English and Creative Writing from the University of Utah. She graduated intending to be a poet, but instead took a 25-year detour into visual art and fine craft. She sold her works all over the U.S. in shops and galleries and shows with the American Craft Council. She also spent a decade doing project design over the country, all over the country, working for a variety of home decor books and women's magazines. She and her husband have raised three daughters. They've moved all over the country, but they finally settled in Arizona, where they've remodeled a beautiful desert home with the intention of staying forever. She currently spends her days drawing a slightly neurotic webcomic called Gray Area. I hope a lot of you will check it out. She tends a cactus garden. She writes. She's a moderator for the A Thoughtful Faith Facebook group. And she sings 70s music, the one and only true decade of music, while speeding in her Mazda Miata. So Susan will speak to us first. Following her, it's my pleasure to introduce you. I mean, I think many of you know him because he speaks every year, and I've kind of been dragging him into Sunstone for 15, 18 years now. But he is just the wonderful speaker, a deeply spiritual person, one of my best friends, one of my greatest mentors, Phil McLemore. And Phil's background is very, very interesting. I'm sure he'll tell some of it. He was an institute teacher who got asked to become a chaplain in the Air Force. He served there for many years. When he retired from that, he was a hospice chaplain, tending to those who are in their last weeks and months of life. And he, along the way, he discovered unfolding in him because of meditation, because of deep contemplation, these spiritual qualities that he had strived for such a long time. While I led Sunstone, he published a couple of articles that just blew when I was the editor there, blew us off. It's The Yoga of Christ and Mormon Mantras. And then since Stephen Carter took over, he's published two more. One is called Hindering the Saints, and the other is Becoming the Beloved. So Phil is a fantastic teacher. He's actually ordained in the lineage of Yogananda, just one step removed from Yogananda himself. And I think you're going to find him very powerful, and he's going to share his journey here in Mormonism. Following those two, I will then introduce Deborah and the choir a little bit, and they're going to just take off and blow the roof off for the last 45 minutes. So, thanks. Susan, thanks so much for coming up.
I'm a short person. It's amazing how good you can make yourself sound when you write your own intro. It's also a little bit embarrassing, but thank you, Dan. Speaking of Why I Stay is an amazing journey, by the way, and if you ever get asked to do it, you should say yes, because having to answer that question in a very concrete way and then stand up in front of you know hundreds of your favorite friends and stand behind that answer is it's a real exercise. But you know, when you're in state conference and you have a particularly spiritual state president who gets up and says, I prepared this talk but I feel impressed to speak to you about something else. And so he throws his notes out. That is not going to happen today. Because if I have to answer why I stay, I am going to need all of my notes. Because, of course, the initial response to why I stay is always, I wish I knew. I wish I knew. So all my notes are here. I kind of want to lower this. Well, maybe I can't. Tech crew to the rescue. Thank you very much. Perfect. Thank you. Thank you, Richard. I once had a psychiatrist who was also a church member tell me, you're a good person. You're just not a very good Mormon. I couldn't even be offended because I knew immediately he was right. There had always been something I couldn't quite put my finger on, but suddenly the fact that I was just not a very good Mormon seemed like something I'd known for a long time. It was hard to hear, but it explained a lot. And that's what we pay professionals for, isn't it? To get the uncomfortable things that we've somehow known, but we don't want to acknowledge, pinned up on the mirror where we can get a good look at them. But what did he mean? I'm not a good Mormon. And what about that phrase spoke truth to my heart when he said it? Well, I'm naturally rebellious, for one thing. I love questions much more than I want answers. And I'm a raging nonconformist. Tell me what I have to do, where, say, or believe. And my first response is always going to be, make me. I'm pretty sure all of that is in my genes somewhere. A hunch confirmed to me recently when an extremely willful daughter confided, I don't know why I'm this way, but I ask the waiter for his recommendations, and no matter how good he makes the thing sound or how much I want it, I can't order it because I'm not going to let anyone tell me what to do. I understood exactly how she feels. So I've thought about it a lot in the roughly 30 years since that diagnostic aside was kindly shared. I believe he meant it to make me feel better. And there was a small validation in it, I suppose. But still, why should I have spent a lifetime showing up every Sunday, sitting reverently and quietly, singing my beloved hymns with real sincerity, holding callings and performing them reliably, carrying a temple recommend that should be a reassurance that I'm handling the checklist about as well as anybody else is, and still feel that somehow, deep inside, programmed by design into my most original equipment, I'm not a good Mormon? Who's at fault? Me or the Mormons? Could it be that we've misunderstood each other? Why I stay is a question that I've been thinking about from the moment I was first old enough to realize I might actually have a choice. But it's a moving target of a question, as changeable as I am. Yesterday's answer doesn't reliably serve today. Which makes me wonder if there isn't something in the ongoing exercise of figuring it out. It's closely related, but not completely identical to another question, one that I've imagined more than heard, asked silently from smug seats in the middle of the room, or aimed squarely from behind the pulpit at my seat in the overflow. Why don't you leave, Susan? Anyone can see you're in the process of leaving. You've been complaining, disagreeing, and uncomfortable for as long as we've known each other. Why don't you leave? I have a much more reliable answer to that question. And my answer is that if someone assumes I'm in the process of leaving, they have misunderstood me. I am in the process of staying. I've been in the process of staying my entire life, but it is a process. I don't feel I should have to apologize for that. Our lives are a moving thing, and just as I'm continually in the process of becoming myself, I don't expect Mormonism to be a permanent destination. I prefer to think of it as a way to something better. But the reason I'm willing to engage in it is that, for me, it's a process of hope. And hope is what carries me from one moment of darkness and uncertainty to my next. Hope is both where and how I live. I had a lonely childhood for many reasons, none of which are important here, but there is one image from it that has stuck with me and continues to inform my life and my journey in Mormonism. Sometimes at night, when the house was dark and quiet and I felt most alone, I would look down from my high window on the street light that stood directly across from our house. It was always there, standing bravely, fending off the darkness in a circle of light it had to draw for itself on the sidewalk. It never faltered. It stood in the dead of winter, crusted with snow and ice, and in summer too, coming on magically just as the last rays of sunlight disappeared at the end of our street. Rather than live in the dark, it just turned on its light, creating a comfortable place for itself to stand. It surrounded itself with exactly what it needed until daylight returned and gave off enough extra to help everyone around it too. I always felt a kinship with that lonely streetlight. Something about the way it lived felt true to me. It lived in hope. At some point in the years since, I realized that in order to have light in my life, in order to have hope, I was going to have to draw a circle for myself to stand in. Being surrounded by love illuminates just such a space, and although I can't completely control anything, I can create love in my life for myself, by loving God and by loving the people around me. Of course, loving God and of my neighbor is also the key identifier of following Jesus Christ, and that means it should be central to being a Mormon and a good one. By generating my own love, my own light, my own hope, drawing a circle for myself and then reliably showing up to stand in it, I not only survive, but sometimes I'm able to throw off a little extra into the darkness around me. And the darkness is an important part of my story. A light becomes more useful as the darkness around it increases. I have felt the dark keenly in my life. But perhaps this acquaintance with it has made me sensitive to even the smallest hint of light. Put simply, Mormonism has always given me the kind of hope from which I could draw a circle of light. I'm not sure why, because it gives me plenty of less desirable emotions too. But the fact that I can't explain it doesn't make it any less real, valuable, or useful. When I was 14 years old, I sensed I'd reached a very distinct crossroads one night. I felt conflicted about my Mormonism, chafing against its constraints, even as I took comfort from the hope that I found there. Tired of feeling pulled both ways, I decided I might find relief if I took more ownership of it. So I picked up my Book of Mormon and started to read. I was going to put the promise to the test. If I decided to be in, I wanted to be in. If not, I felt it was high time I figured that out. I tried to read with real intent over the next few weeks. And when I finished, I prayed hard. My connection to Mormonism has always felt more personal than doctrinal. We're each looking for just the right quality of light to illuminate our darkness, and my darkness isn't born of big questions needing big answers. It's a need to connect the small dots of my human experience and then find a connection to others. And the increase of peace I received from those prayers came with a sense of place. The feeling of looking at a map with a bright dot that said, "You are here." It wasn't an undeniable witness of truth, but it was something real and personal. Hope revealed with a witness that I was standing in my place and need only turn on my light. In the many years since, I've referred to it as my pesky experience with the Book of Mormon, because I've never been able to extinguish it, nor ever wanted to in my heart, no matter how much my head has insisted that I should. Whether it's that, or the many other things that have bound me, the simple truth is, I've never felt at liberty to leave. I'm not sure how to leave what I am, and I am a Mormon in very deep places and ways that even I can't figure out how to extinguish or turn off. If you're going to say I'm not a good Mormon, you may as well say I'm not a good me, because I don't know how to be anything but this. As I look back across my lifetime of membership, I see a long string of lights from which I continue to draw hope. People and ideas, feelings and experiences, a brightness of small things taken together where my heart returns when I need spiritual rest, if only for a moment. They are uniquely mine, a gift perhaps only I can see, but they illuminate my path and nudge me forward. There was so much to love in my Mormon upbringing, so much of light, of virtue and loveliness, so much that was praiseworthy, so much of good report. I loved the primary songs that later became lullabies for my babies. Tell me the stories of Jesus and little purple pansies, and whenever I hear the song of a bird. Laughing at the chorister who had saggy skin wagging from her aging arms, hair piled up miles above her head, and a tremulous voice that was louder than the room was big. But even then, knowing she had other things she could be doing, and being grateful she was there, I took comfort in her kind hand moving up and down with each note to show us where to sing. I wanted to grow up to wear the same white patent leather boots. I loved the organ, booming its familiar hymns while my mother beat time for the congregation, her white baton swinging with feeling and her lipsticked mouth worshiping in a deep red alto O. She led the music as if God himself had called her to it, because he obviously had. I loved the kids I grew up with, the same faces year after year, their dresses, their curled hair, their questions, their freckles, their boredom, their rebellion, their snickering, the inside jokes, the walks home after. I loved my teachers, all the unlikely ones who showed up anyway when we did not deserve their time or love. We listened with one ear, watched with one eye, kicked the chair in front of us with both feet, and ran our mouths nonstop in an attempt to prove that we already knew much more than anyone could ever teach us. Still, I remember treats in a battered aluminum pan, a handbag on the table next to an open lesson manual underlined in careful pencil, glimpses of my faith through a different mirror than the one I lived with, a flannel board, a magnet for the fridge, a token to remind me that my teacher cared, but Jesus cared about me most of all. I loved the dresses my grandma made. Years of Sunday ruffles in patterns and fabrics picked just for me. No one ever had the same clothes I had. How could they? Sitting next to her in church one day, I heard her sing that God is love and realized with satisfaction, I already knew that. Somehow she and God had made it plain. I loved the fabric of our ward. Families lined up in their Sunday best, throwing off their lives and showing up like clockwork. Kind bishops, crying babies, missionaries who caught a Hail Mary haircut and were off to save the world, or perhaps themselves. Mothers who never doubted. Grown-ups knowing who I was and where I came from, caring where I went next. The booming man in the seersucker suit, the barrel-chested janitor, the head cheerleader, the orthodontist who loved poetry, that woman always on the second row, stick straight in a fox fur, its pointy face pinned just below hers. The same characters in every performance, pillars of my childhood faith. There was a hint of eternity in the constancy of it, so much of humanity in the details. I loved my youth leaders, their hours so freely spent, the man who gave me water skiing, his zinc-white nose a legend under his threadbare hat, circling the boat as I dropped the rope again and again and again. He ignored my begging, my chattering teeth, promising if I tried just once more, I'd see. He knew I could, even as I insisted I couldn't. He was right. I loved suddenly being old enough to sing in our ward choir, everyone showing up at 6 a.m. Friday mornings to spend an hour lost in the wonder of God so loving the world before the day began. Easter cantatas and Christmas miracles, the battle hymn of the Republic in July, and tears on the cheeks of the conductor when we raised the last amen, and it was good. I loved the complexity, things I didn't understand, things that spoke to my heart directly, doctrines that answered one question but raised a dozen more, the secret feeling I was smarter than the teacher, the realization I knew nothing at all, holy envy of another's truth. The beautiful language of the scriptures, fantastic stories in equal parts, faith-promoting and troubling. Ideas much too big. Light through cracks. Good people who I knew did bad things, and people called bad who I knew to be good. Prayers answered or ignored. Figuring out which rules mattered and which never would. The tree of polygamy that offended deeply, but produced good fruit, like me. Learning to keep walking while my heart and brain wrestled it all. I loved summer reunions. Ancient cousins swapping genealogy in the dappled shade of a small town city park. Picnic tables heaped with jello and funeral potatoes and six kinds of cake. The buzz of children and swatting of flies. And everyone eager for the blessing on the food. I loved the blessing itself. Its familiar cadence. Its second nature phrases. The thankful language of food and family. The sustenance of belonging. The moments of light that began in my childhood have continued as I've lived my Mormon life, in and out of wards, in and out of callings, in and out of belief, of faith, of hope. I gather them, I guard them. It's not good to feel alone. In fact, the whole point of the organized church is that we don't have to be so. I rarely find strength or comfort in another's silence. It's difficult to learn or grow, to help or understand from things that remain unsaid. So I think a good Mormon is one who throws their light on the sidewalk to improve their own place, but also in hopes it might help someone else feel less alone in the dark. As a child, I learned of loneliness and was called to turn on my light. I've been learning to use it ever since. To be a Mormon is to be in a process of conversion, of doubt, of faith and hope, and wending our infinite separate ways. We're always engaged in finding our path or staying on it. We're always in the process of becoming who we can. So I stand where I am and I draw my circle. I am here. At long last, somehow, I've been gifted the understanding that I am known, that my lifelong struggle with traditional or reliable belief has not marked me as faithless, but rather as a woman of great faith. Every time I act in accordance with my hope, I am shown a glimpse of my own light. And surely that's the point of church, to allow us to catch sight now and then of what is possible. I suppose this means I do believe. Whether it is something about Mormonism or something about myself, I believe in the hope at the bottom of it all that speaks peace to my lonely heart. Why do I stay? Because I want to be a light much bigger and brighter than I am now. And I feel it could happen if I'm willing to keep showing up with the wounded and weary and disenfranchised every Sunday, each of us a little less alone when we recognize something true in the other. Standing together in a circle of collective light, we draw for ourselves and anyone who needs it. I only hope the process lasts forever. Thank you.
Oh man, I was hoping there'd be a treat up here. I was expecting a candy bar or something up there. Okay, well, after Dan's generous introduction, I'm a little nervous. I might be too negative, so start praying for me, one and all. I am going to have to read. I hate to read in situations like this, but 18 minutes, one of my mental sidetracks takes 18 minutes. So here we go. Why I stay. I stay for the one, and that one is three. My wife, God, him, her, itself, and the ones within the LDS Church awakening to a deeper spiritual life beyond traditional Mormonism. I have many, many problems with Mormonism. historical problems, Joseph Smith problems, doctrinal problems, cultural problems. 3 hours of straight talking would not cover it. Special mention, I'm seriously disturbed by a missionary program that's based on salesmanship principles and not spiritual living. An amen. Yes. A coercive way of requiring money from members who cannot afford it. The way women have been treated disrespectfully and dishonestly. The worship of leaders over God himself. An obsession with image over truth and substance. And the fact that a false gospel is being taught that does not result in spiritual rebirth. I really needed what Mormonism had to offer when I was baptized at age 19. My life was going nowhere, and Mormonism provided me with a personal connection to God, life purpose, and encouragement and support to live a moral, responsible, mature life. In spite of the fact that much of what I was taught was technically untrue, it was foundational to stable and productive living for me. Mormonism literally saved my life at that point. I had a great mission experience in Brazil in spite of being in a mission where deception, dishonesty, coercion, and bullying were common, so we could become the highest baptizing mission in the world. Where I got the courage to resist the ungodly practices and mission culture, I'm still not sure, but I was blessed by being punished as I was sent on a 10-hour bus ride to the edge of the mission to serve in a two-missionary city with no supervision. This limited my ability to influence the mission with honesty, love, and a commitment to teach the gospel in the Spirit of Christ, but provided me with the opportunity to do so in my little area. After mission in college, I was employed by the church educational system and served as a seminary supervisor in Alabama and Georgia, and as an Institute of Religion director at Auburn University and the University of Georgia. I was obsessed with a desire to study the church's history and teachings deeply and extensively, believing that the more I knew, the more inspired and inspiring I could be. Instead, I spent many nights hidden in my closet, weeping about and fearful of what I was learning. My identity was so enmeshed with the church, I had to resolve the conflicts or face personal extinction. I pursued that course for 30 years. In the early 1980s, I was the church expert on anti-Mormon materials, which had expanded from books to audio and video programs, and which were causing thousands of Latter-day Saints to leave the church. A well-known church scholar and I were commissioned by the church to digest the anti-Mormon materials of that time, which I had already done, and to prepare responses to the issues being raised. As I remember, we identified about 200 issues and grouped them in 10 categories and were able to provide good or reasonable responses to all but two. We sent our work into church headquarters and waited for feedback. I'm not sure how word of our project got out, but some wealthy, troubled Latter-day Saints flew across the country to visit with me to have their minds and hearts soothed with our responses. We also began doing firesides and stakes and missions to help those being affected by the materials or to inoculate them against future assaults. After 2 months, I received a call from a future member of the Presidency of the 70 who overwhelmed us with praise for our work. He then perceptively said, "I bet you two are talking to a lot of folks." "Yes, sir." He said, "I bet you two are getting invitations to speak to many groups." I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "I bet you two are planning on writing a book." I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Well, we are going to ask you to stop speaking to others, to put your materials in a file cabinet and lock it, and to do no writing on the subject." I said, "Let me guess, you were concerned that more members might be troubled by the issues being raised than helped." He said, "Yes, most aren't aware of these issues, and some might not find your responses satisfying." I turned to my colleague who was listening to my side of the conversation and said, "They want us to protect the 99 and they're willing to let the lost sheep go. Why members need protection, if this is the true gospel of Christ, raises an interesting question. We had helped hundreds to stay in the church at that point, but now this growing group of lost sheep was considered expendable. I made an inner commitment at that point that I would always, always serve the one, regardless of the impact on the flock. For a number of reasons, religious freedom being one, I left the church educational system and worked and served as an active duty Air Force chaplain for 21 years. 99% of my work had nothing to do with Latter-day Saints. However, because I had some training in marriage counseling, local LDS bishops would often refer LDS couples to me for counseling. It was as I worked with these couples that I realized that LDS belief and practice was not deeply transformative. I saw it in them at first, and then one day I honestly looked in the mirror and saw that it had not been for me. And at that point, I had spent 30 years studying and living the gospel professionally, paid to pray, paid to study. It should have worked for me. Toward the end of my military career, I was injured and found myself in a nightmare of chronic pain, which evolved into a merry-go-round of alternating severe depression and anxiety. My injuries had been misdiagnosed and thus untreated. As a last-ditch effort, I turned to meditation and what I call inner path work to help me manage my unrelenting symptoms. After a few months, I began to receive substantial relief from my symptoms, but then to my surprise, a whole new world of spiritual knowledge and experience was unveiled. I was now motivated to study the history, development, and processes of meditation and inner work. This inner path has been my focus for the last 20 years. Through a series of synchronistic events, I was able to be taught and mentored by Deepak Chopra in the early stages of my understanding of and experience with inner path. And for the past 12 years, I've been a disciple and then friend of Roy Eugene Davis, who is the last living direct guru disciple of the famous Indian yogi Yogananda. Roy is 87 years old now and has been actively teaching and preaching and practicing inner path work for over 67 years. To have his knowledge and experience transmitted to me has been an indescribable blessing. Within 3 years of the start of my meditation practice, I felt completely spiritually independent and assumed full responsibility for my spiritual life. My sense of self, my identity, my life and being were consciously established in God. I no longer needed to justify or rationalize the problems and issues with and within the LDS Church. And so, yoked with Christ, my burden was and is light. The Mormonism which had given birth to my spiritual life now seemed sterile and immature. When I retired from the military, I decided I would no longer accept any administrative or leadership callings in the church. I could not promote or support the mainstream agenda. In our first ward after retirement, I ended up teaching gospel doctrine for 10 years. Under three different inspired bishops who gave me amazing support in spite of the fact that I did not go by the manuals, emphasize the standard teachings, and the state continually reprimanded them for not releasing me. I focused on inner growth as the primary purpose of the gospel and service as an outgrowth of inner awakening and rebirthing and not as an end in itself. I also began teaching meditation and contemplative prayer to numerous groups of Latter-day Saints throughout Utah and many of the western states, and continue to do so today. To be fair, and to provide some balance, I must say, in spite of my many issues with the church, on two occasions when two different state presidents, threatened to take my temple recommend for not being willing to support leadership excesses or ill-conceived and coercive programs. And that was quite a threat because I needed the temple recommend for my job. In both cases, general authorities got involved, and in both cases, they supported me. In one case that was particularly difficult, Elder Uchtdorf proved to be a master mediator. Also, because of my jobs and some special projects I've done for the church, I've been able to interact with a number of the brethren who have dealt with me honestly and lovingly. On three occasions, Elder Marion D. Hanks, Elder Hugh Pinnock, and Elder, I forgot his first name, Kikuchi, stepped into our lives proactively when my wife was suffering with injuries. And serious health problems. They demonstrated amazing love and inspiration and ministered to her in unique ways. One of these blessings resulted in a miraculous healing, which allowed her to travel and be with her father, who had a heart attack the next week. I could mention several more who extended themselves to be of service to both my wife and myself professionally and personally. 2.5 years ago, we moved into a new ward, and I did not blend in as easily as I had in the previous ward. I violated my church calling policy and did serve for a year in the high priest group leadership to see if it was possible to do inter-path things in typical priesthood leadership. Although a few individuals were positively impacted, I learned that the new wine of spiritual awakening and rebirth, does not fit in the old bottle of traditional church leadership. I asked to be released from my calling. I stopped home teaching, stopped going to Sunday school, and would sit in the foyer and simply read. Last April, on a day when I was church irritated by an aspect of church culture that was causing conflict in the family of one of my children, I was notified by the bishopric that the bishopric, all three, wanted to meet with me. I assumed my lack of faithfulness had generated this meeting and that it would be armed conflict since all three would be present. I went prepared to do battle. To my surprise, they called me to be the gospel doctrine teacher. I said, "Bishop, you really don't want me." I said, "Sir, I am way out of the mainstream. I have not attended class for over 2 years. You've seen me in the hallway reading. And sir, I will not go by the manuals." I assumed those red flags would generate a more searching interview. But my truly wonderful bishop, and he is a fabulous human being, said, "Brother McLemore, prayer and inspiration have gone into this calling, and we trust it." I saluted and said, "When do I start?" "The class has been fabulous. We are doing inappropriate stuff." Correction, we are doing inner path stuff as appropriate to the scriptures. So despite my best efforts, God seems determined to have me serve Latter-day Saints in and out of church settings and to be blessed by Latter-day Saints in and out of church settings. So why do I stay? I stay for the ones, my one wife, the one God, and the wandering ones of Mormonism. Number one, my wife, who contributes in significant and out-of-the-box ways at church, still loves the church deeply and has hope for its improvement. I do not have that love nor hope, but I love her, and I'm going to be with her in every aspect of life. Number two, God at this point has not let me escape, has preserved me in moments of membership peril, and continues to find ways for me to serve even when I run for the sidelines. So I will serve him and his will within Mormonism in the context of what I know to be true. Number three, an awakening is taking place among thousands of individual Mormons. They realize deep spiritual life is not present in standard church teaching programs and practice, but it's there. Some are redefining faith and spiritual life, hoping to be a source of inspiration in the context of traditional Mormonism. God bless them. Thousands more are scattering in many different directions. Some of these paths are helpful, some are not. Some are retreating into bitterness and criticism. Some are banding together and finding ways to create productive and satisfying lives. New alternative LDS groups are arising. From my limited perspective, it seems to be the same stuff with a touch of fanaticism, or an obsession with spiritual, supernatural phenomena, both good and evil. In some cases, craziness is masquerading as revelation, and self-deception is coupled with fantasy and fanaticism. A surprising number have become atheists. I get it, since church culture has a way of taking the place of God rather than leading members to God. So when the church is rejected for one reason or another, God is also rejected. I am deeply grateful to have realized the love and life of God and will be present for those who have wandered from or are leaving the flock in search of genuine spiritual life. Many that have, and some leave physically, some leave in mind and heart. Many that have worked with me are able to stay in the church because their personal spiritual lives are alive and growing, and they want to remain for personal or family reasons. Many that have worked with me have left the church once they've established spiritual independence. Many have already left, but have now awakened to the love and presence of God. I only care that they are experiencing vibrant life in God, church or no church. As for me, I'm still here. Thank you.
I love those two. Thank you. What Phil was just saying, I think in some ways plays into what Deborah and her mission in life is, and that's to awaken to spirit through praise music, through song, through, you know, getting out of our heads where we, so many of us here, right? We're all head cases. and being able to get into this heart space and this joyful, you know, relationship with God. And so I'm really thrilled for that little bit of a crossover. Let me now introduce Deborah and then the choir a little bit. I talk louder, like this way. Yeah, okay, yeah, I was going to do this. You're right. I should do this now. For those of you who were impressed with this kind of writing and personal essay that focuses here, Why I Stay has been published since 2011. It's a collection of 20-some of these talks. And then Bob Reese was the editor of this, and he's completing a second volume right now. I think mine's in it. At least it was at one time. So at Benchmark Books, there's a few copies of this left if anybody wants to kind of explore that. Anything else, Bob? Next year, should be published. Great, thanks. Deborah Bonner grew up in Flint, Michigan, singing in gospel choirs from an early age. She's been a professional voice coach for 45 years. 30 of those have been spent training and working with the top two vocal pedagogues of the 20th century as their close associate. Deborah and her vocal students have trained well over 100 Grammy, Tony, and Opera Award winners. As a professional soloist, Deborah has performed all over the world and has developed her own vocal technique, Deborah Tone. Through the choir, she's able to continue her personal mission of transforming lives through song, giving people hope, joy, and self-esteem by helping her fellow brothers and sisters find their true, authentic voice singing gospel music. The Deborah Bonner Unity Gospel Choir is a multicultural Latter-day Saint choir with a mission to help heal souls through gospel music. The choir believes that Christ's teachings, shared through the joy of gospel music, invite us, all of us, to come together in unity because we're all children of the Father in heaven. Choir members share a diversity of religious, cultural, ethnic, and political backgrounds, and are unified simply by the mutual desire to help individuals overcome life's challenges through a love of the Lord and a love for gospel music. And I am thankful. This was about half of the choir, a little bit less than half of the choir. Look, it's 95 degrees. They wore black. And many of them had to take off work. They had to arrange to get off work to come here on a Friday afternoon. So throughout this last 45 minutes, Deborah's going to speak. Tim Schwartz is going to speak a little bit, and so is Tom Reed. But Deborah's going to lead us, and I think we're going to intersperse song and these little presentations. So for this last 45 minutes, come on. Okay, thanks, Deborah.
First, I'd like to say I am not a speaker. I talk, though. I guess that's the question, why I stay. Well, you have to understand that when I was a little girl, I used to fight all the time. Every day I fought. And back then, girls wore dresses and skirts, so I always had to wear shorts under my dress because every day I would be fighting somebody. And it was like a game, a bunch of kids just rally around in a circle, and there you and another kid fighting. Now, why did I fight? Because I was always taking up for somebody. The underdog, somebody who's being bullied. And this is elementary school, mind you. So it was pretty safe back then, you know, as elementary school kid. And, you know, so if somebody pick on someone, I'd say, that's my sister, don't pick on my sister, you know. So then it got to a point where, because I was fighting every day, then people who thought they could beat me wanted to fight me. Right? So I had to fight every day. So either I was taking up for somebody or I was fighting because somebody, it was like Billy the Kid or something, you know? Yeah. Who's the fastest gun type person, right? So also, elementary school, I was considered mildly retarded. So I said, well, I'm retarded anyway, right? That's what we do. So I just accepted the fact that I was retarded. And so I couldn't read. So by the age of 13, I still couldn't read. And I remember going, I was a special ed child. So I remember the teacher saying, S. And I go, S. M. And they go back to S. And I couldn't remember. I could never remember. So I couldn't retain. Then something happened, fifth grade. There was a little girl. I'm from Michigan, Flint, Michigan. And there was this little girl moved to up north. And she had a lot of little braids on her head. About 100 of them. And different color bows on each one. And she was from the South. She was from Mississippi. And she was tall and very dark. Dark was not in back then. Plus she had all, and she had a Southern accent. She was tall. Kids would pick on her and she'd cry. Of course, I had to defend her, right? So I had to fight. And I couldn't understand why. Why don't you just grab them? And I was short. She could just grab them, throw them down, and sit on them, and that's it. But she wouldn't do it. And she said, my friend wouldn't like it. I mean, I came to admire her because she had strength and did not use her strength to destroy. So I began to admire this girl with all this strength, and she wouldn't fight. So she said, my friend. And I said, well, I want to meet your friend. Who's your friend? Guess who her friend was? Jesus was her friend. She said, I'll take you to his house. I said, okay. So she introduced me to her friend, Jesus. And she was in a choir. She had a beautiful voice. And I was like, oh, I want a voice like that. I want to be able to sing like that. I said, Lord, if you give me a voice, I'll stop fighting. And I came to know Jesus through the gospel music. I came to know him personally through gospel music. And by singing the hymns, I learned how to read. That's how I learned how to read. It was by singing, you know, with the notes and the words and trying my best to understand. And I came to know Jesus personally, and he was my best friend. So it didn't matter. I was always, I guess, the type that it didn't matter what anybody thought of me. I mean, after all, I was retarded, right? So, you know, I am who I am, right? So in learning how to read, the Lord, and getting to know him personally, I would go in a corner and I would just talk to Jesus. Things I didn't understand in school, I would talk to Jesus, and Jesus would speak to me. He would speak to my mind. He helped me understand my math. He helped me understand what I was reading. And my mind just expanded. And because I was considered mildly retarded, they kept a track with me. And then by the time I was in seventh grade, my IQ jumped to like 120 something. And then by the time I finished junior high, going into high school, it was 135. And I was like, I didn't know what that was, but I did know that I could understand many things and even understand things that most people didn't get. So it was because of that relationship with the Savior that I understood, and he changed my life. Anything I wanted in life, I could ask the Lord and he would give it to me. Anything. It was like anything. And so Jesus was my best friend. I came to know Jesus through gospel music. So when I graduated, so I guess then they allowed me to get in the choir. And I was like an orphan child in this church because it was like a family church. Families would go, like Mormons, you know, the whole family go. But I would go by myself. I didn't have family to go with me. So that little black church on the corner took me in and nurtured me and loved me. And let me be me. They let me be who I was. Of course, when I went home, I couldn't be me, you know. My mother, I remember my mother saying, "You're the worst thing in the house." That was what she would say. And I was like, oh, well, I guess I'm the worst thing in the house. But, you know, but at church, I could get away with stuff that their kids couldn't get away with. And they just loved me unconditionally. And it changed my life. And they paid for my voice lessons at the age of 13 and a half because the Lord gave me a voice. And I got in the choir. And they paid for my voice lessons twice a week from the age of 13 until I was 18. Twice a week. And they sought after the best voice teacher they could find. And that's who I trained with. So by the time I graduated from high school, I sang throughout Europe as a classical recording artist, as a teenager. And I sang for the Dukes and the Duchess, gave them flowers and sang for them. I was with a group. It was 100 voice choir and an orchestra. And I was the soloist. And there were only 2 black kids in that group. Me and Linda Gill, my friend. But she was so shy. So it gave me almost all the solos. I was the soloist, right? So That was my childhood. And I couldn't sing gospel anymore. I couldn't, my voice was so trained classically that when I tried to sing gospel, it sounded like opera. It was awful. And I thought, I've been duped. They destroyed me. But it allowed me to get scholarships, you know, throughout college. So I never had to pay a penny for my education because of vocal scholarships. So why am I saying all that? After I got my master's from University of Michigan, met my husband, and I, you know, still training, vocal performance major at the University of Michigan. And right after, I mean, after I graduated, married Harry. We were in church, my old church that I grew up in Michigan. And it was a missionary, traveling missionary, right? And he always say, that's my, when I was a little girl, every time he come, every year, he said, that's my little missionary. That's going to be my little missionary. Now, here I am with a husband, and he comes through, and he says, hi, that's my little missionary. I want you to go to Africa. Can you go to Africa and be a missionary? I said, yes, of course. I said, oh, Harry, you want to go? And Harry said, Africa? Yeah, I'll go. So we went to Liberia, West Africa, and we were there for almost 2 years. We wind up living in the village or the jungle with the people in their mud houses, loving the work, teaching them about Jesus, teaching them about Jesus. But they taught us about Jesus. They lived the gospel. And we were trying to teach them what Jesus said. And that's why they loved it so, because it was their way of life. That's the way they lived. So then the Spirit told us to, told me, Jesus said, resign. Resign from this mission. We were going to live in the jungles forever. We were going to have our kids, and our kids are going to be missionaries. You know, and their kids is going to be missionaries, because that's the way the Baptists do it, you know. So they had 12 missionaries that represented over 4 million black people in America. 12. So me and Harry were like 2 of the 12. It was like that. Yeah. And can you imagine an apostle resigning? Said, God told me to do it. So that was a hard thing to do. But I knew when the Spirit spoke to me, I knew. It was like my mother speaking to me. I know my mother's voice. I know the Lord's voice. We were best buds. Right? So I said, Harry, Spirit said, resign. Harry said, a what? Okay, well, let's do it. Resign. The people were very upset. In fact, I thought they were so angry with us that I thought they were going to kill us. I really did. And so what they did say, they said, well, then, you get back the best way you can. We had no money, no way of taking care of ourselves, and the people in the village say, we want you to come live with us. And they were happy and clapping their hands, and we were like, yes, that's what we'll do. We'll live with the people. But we were baptizing hand over fist. A lot of Muslims from different villages would come. They wanted to see, who are these people? And we taught about Jesus, and we were baptizing. We were baptizing a lot of Muslims. And word got back in America. And they got angry. They said, "You are an embarrassment living in those mud houses with those heathens and blah, 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 blah." And I'm like, what? That's why the Lord told me to resign. You know? So they came back to Africa, got our plane tickets, and said, "You got to go home." And we said, "We don't want to go home. We'll stay here." They said, "We talked to the government. We brought you. You got to go." So we went back. To make a long story short, so many miracles, though. Came back to the States. And the Lord told us to go west. We say, "West? What's west? We don't know nobody west. I live in the Midwest." By that time, we had a three-year-old, a one-year-old, and I was 7 months pregnant. We had a car because when we first got back, I taught in the inner city of Cincinnati, Ohio, and it was a lot high crime, high teenage pregnancy, you know, drugs. And I loved the work. And I was teaching the kids and building choirs and doing productions. And all my money went back into these productions and working with these kids and changing lives. And I was baptizing kids in my tub. And I didn't know you couldn't baptize. I was a school teacher. Can you? So I'm teaching them about Jesus, baptizing them in my tub. And nobody really cared because, you know, they're inner city kids and nobody, you know, cared. So they... Oh, you get me off? Is it time for me to go? I know, but I'm going to tell you, I'm coming. I'm getting there. So, Spirit said, "Resign from the job and go west." Me and Harry went west. Within a week, we had $100 to our name, by the way. A three-year-old, one-year-old, 7 months pregnant, right? How much time we got? We'll have time. I got to set it up. You got to understand what happened, okay? So, if it's boring, I won't say anymore. Is it okay? Okay. I mean, I can dish it out so I can take it. If it's too much, let me know. My choir can tell you I can dish it out. Okay. So, in the 3 days with $300, so by the way, we gave our car to my parents because my parents didn't have a car in Michigan. So we basically hitchhiked west with $100. Two babies and 7 months pregnant. 3 days we stayed in the hotel. We were able to stay in a hotel and eat. Then the fourth day, we're out of money. We had $18. So we stayed in a shelter. Can you imagine two people with master's degrees, transients in Vegas, staying in a shelter? That's what we did. I said, "Harry, this is a dirty place. We will stay in the park tomorrow." So Harry met some guys with white shirts and black pants. He thought they were Catholic because Harry used to be Catholic. And they gave him their bishop number. So there we are at the Palace Station. Is that the name of it? Downtown Palace Station. It was something Palace. It's still there. And Harry was on the phone talking to the bishop. And smiling and laughing and talking. I'm like, what is this man doing? I'm trying to stay awake on the, you know, sitting on the bench. Because if we fall asleep or look like we're transients, they're going to kick us out. That that's what we were. We were transients. And the bishop came and said, my wife and I have been praying for somebody to help. If it's no inconvenience, can you come and stay with us? No inconvenience. So we did. Long story short, the bishop, he was, you know who Archie Bunker is, right? He was like an Archie Bunker. He came to love us. And I wasn't much better. I was kind of like a George Jefferson. But the thing about it was, they were like our parents. They'd come to love us like we were their children. And he would say, well, you know you curse, right? I'm like, what? And here, they're, you know, the missionaries coming over every day teaching us out of the Book of Mormon. I'm like, I don't want to read that because some voodoo or something may come out of there, because I know how it was in Africa, and that thing is real. So, to make a long story short, some miracles happened where we actually prayed about it. Didn't want to pray about it. But some things happened. So we prayed, and the Spirit said, be baptized in this church at this time. I'm like, wow. Now, they loved us, but we lived with them for 2 months, going to their church back in 82. Only black people, some of them have ever seen in their life, I'm sure. And they, people in that ward, were not nice to us. Was not nice. They didn't talk to us. They thought we were just mooching off of their bishop. So they, and I said, this is the Church of Jesus Christ? That's not the Jesus I know. That's not the Jesus I know. And I remember, I only had two dresses, two cotton dresses, and they were getting worn and tattered. And here I am with my two babies and way out here pregnant. Nobody talked to me. And there was a lady, she had a stroller, she was kind of wealthy. And she was going to have a baby, and they gave her a shower. And I'm like, that don't make sense to me. That's not the Jesus I know. Well, but the Lord said, later, said, be baptized in this church at this time. So I did. And thus began the journey. Usually I wear kind of African kind of clothes. I sang as a guest soloist with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, and I took my shoes off and kicked it under the piano and sung the solo right there in the tabernacle, right? So I still don't really care what people think, you know, and that's a good thing. So my journey was a tough journey, because I still haven't changed. I say, I will not be like the Mormons. I'm going to be like Jesus. Try to be like Jesus taught me to be. We'd always take people in our homes. We always, you know, take people who are eating out of garbage cans. Come get them in. And we have 8 children now. When we lived in Vegas for 15 years, we've had at least 13 sets of people who have lived with us. Some joined the church, some didn't. But that's because of the way I was raised in the gospel that I know, right? Now, they teach that same gospel in Relief Society, but they don't do it. So it's been difficult, very, very difficult. I've been judged. I've even had to, when I bore my testimony, I remember saying one time, I said, similar to the sister that spoke, that was beautiful, sister. That was poetic. Wasn't that poetic? It was poetic. I said, I know you don't want me here, but I ain't going nowhere. That's what I had to tell them in the pulpit. So but my children, it has been difficult sometime walking in there with my children, 8 children, and sitting down and nobody talked to you, nobody want to talk to you, or even telling my kids as they got older, don't listen to your mother. She doesn't know the gospel. They're leaders. Listen to your dad. Don't listen to your mother. But I keep going because the Lord is where he put me. And I remember he said, be baptized at this time. So I said, one day he will release me. But I'm going to keep going and I'm going to keep trying to live the gospel and teach my children about Jesus. And I had to do that research because they said that my kids were cursed. I was cursed. So I started doing research and talked to a Dr. Fuller Royal. I don't know if anybody know who Dr. Fuller Royal is in here. He's kind of like that man right there. And he came every day and taught me the fullness of the gospel. So I knew it. And I also knew that Joseph Smith gave men the priesthood, black men the priesthood during his time. So I was like, okay. So, and I knew, I understood and learned that history. So I was able to teach it to my children. All my children have a very healthy self-esteem. They know who they are and they love the Savior. And this gospel is true. This is the gospel of Jesus Christ. The gospel is real. Sometimes people misinterpret it or they may not live it. But this gospel is real. The priesthood is real. We've had a lot of miracles. Children's lives spared by giving them the priesthood. So why do I stay? Because it's true. This church, and I've said this to some people too, this is not your church. This is the church of Jesus Christ. That is why I stay. And it has been difficult. It's been a hard journey. My kids, they're part of the culture. So they get it. I still don't quite get it. But that's okay. And I also know that you are my brothers and my sisters, and I love you. You are my Father in Heaven's children, and I love you. I love you. Okay. 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 Ready? Okay.
So the choir even knows. Have you guys sing a song, and then Tim and Tom will go right next to each other, and then we'll at least have one big final one.
Okay, that's good. Choir, let's do it.
I love Jesus. We don't have time for my story today. And I want you to know it didn't come easy, just like the rest of us. Fair enough? Okay. Now, how I got involved in this choir, that's another story we don't have time for. Awesome. Now, we're going to post all that online because we're doing testimonials of how we got here and what we believe in. So I encourage you, when Tom gets up to show how to follow us on social media, just do it. Did you like Chicken Soup for Soul in the 90s? Because that's where we're headed. We're going to bring it. We're going to bring it right. And it's going to show that we do love God and we are about unity and diversity. We were invited to sing at the luncheon where the NAACP and the LDS Church shook hands. The spirit in that room, as we left and let them talk about what they needed to talk about, was on point, as they say. We prayed to God that we would do that, and we're grateful we were allowed to. Now, from that room, we were invited to go to their national convention in San Antonio, Texas, raised the donations required to buy the plane tickets, and made our way down there, pulling off 7 concerts in 5 days. We want that mission to continue. In one weekend, San Antonio decided they wanted a branch of our choir, and we want to give it to them. As we continue to fight for an audience through the LDS Church and the NAACP, we'll be making a joint music video that will allow us to spread our message further than anyone else thought. We knew. We knew. We know. Because the power of music heals. Many of you probably even know the scientific reasons why. That our testimony is easier felt through music. We don't have time for that. What we do have time for is to say that we will continue to release albums and songs, music videos, and do performances. And the way we're headed after that is to start helping the community beyond the music, taking people away from anxiety, depression, suicide, bringing them the light of the gospel of Jesus Christ, so beautifully taught through gospel music. And I'd like you to turn your attention to Tom. Help us however you can.
As he said, our mission is to help heal souls through the gospel music and through the teachings of Jesus Christ. And we love performing. We love connecting with our audiences. And we want to connect with you right now. So, we want you to get your phones out right now. We want to stay connected. We want to share the goodness and love that we have with you directly. The best way to do that is to have you jump on social media. So, we're on all these platforms, and I'm going to take you through them real fast. So, you can search for Deborah Bonner Unity Gospel Choir. Many of you have a card. We also have brochures, but search for Deborah Bonner Unity Gospel Choir. So, if you're on Facebook, this is what you're looking for on Facebook. Deborah Bonner Unity Gospel Choir, or you can use the handle. Search for Deborah Bonner Unity Gospel Choir. Take a picture. It'll last longer, right? Okay, so let's do that. Take a picture of this one for Facebook. And here's Instagram. We're also on Instagram. Same handle here. And you can like us there. We also tweet. So if you're into Twitter, I know a lot in the Mormon Twitter sphere are out there, and they love to tweet. So, and our handle's a little different here. There's a character restriction on Twitter, so it's DB Gospel Choir. And then also on YouTube. So we talked about videos. We put out new music on the regular basis, videos from different performances you may even see today up there here soon. So please, we'd love for you to connect with us. And to learn more about our story, you can go to our website, which is dbunitygospelchoir.org. So if you want to take only one picture today of the screen to remember how to connect with us, this would be the one to get. dbunitygospelchoir.org is our website. You can connect to social media through there, but you can also donate. You can help support this ministry financially. You can help us go to areas, you know, beyond San Antonio and throughout the United States and throughout the world. This message of healing and hope through the gospel of Jesus Christ needs to permeate the world. And you can help us make that happen by donating and supporting the Deborah Bonner Unity Gospel Choir. So without further ado, we'll do our last number for you today. And if you want to connect again and you didn't get pictures, I'll be roaming the room and give you literature if you need paper stuff. I got that for you too. So thank you.
This is one of the songs we sang at the luncheon. It's a great work that's being done by the church. You know, they've gone to Africa, we've gone a lot of places, but now they've decided to, right in our backyard, to help communities with education and learning how to build their own businesses. And we want to be a part of that. We'll be building choirs all over America, Unity Gospel choirs that will be that link between the church and the NAACP. That's our hope, one of our missions. Okay, you ready? And things are going to get better.
Come on, everybody, and put your hands together. It's gotta get better. All over the world, listen to these words. People come.
People come.
People go.
People go.
Your life has been.
Out of control.
You're confused.
You're confused.
But don't worry.
Don't worry, your soul will get better.
It's gotta get
better. I learned
how to be knowing God.
so much. On behalf of the Sunstone Board, we want to thank Deborah and Susan and Philip for sharing their wonderful stories, inspiring stories of faith with us about why they stay. And Deborah and Philip and Susan, if you come up, we have some gifts for you. And thank you to the Unity Gospel Choir.